Product Breakfast Club.
Product Breakfast Club.
Product Breakfast Club is part of this complete
Breakfast Club. Breakfast Club.
Hash browns, Pop Tarts, steel cut oats, cold cereal.
Hello.
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 Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Product Breakfast Club. I'm your host of the Product Breakfast Club, Jake Knapp.
I'm your other host of the Product Breakfast Club, Jonathan Courtney, and welcome to one of the top shows about product stuff, innovation stuff, design stuff, and a lot of rambling, a lot of silliness.
So much rambling.
And seriousness.
And sometimes a little drop of seriousness.
Yeah, a little squirt of seriousness. And we also love Apple. There's so much to talk about, Jake, because we haven't chatted in 2 weeks.
No, it's just been, you've been doing interviews. I wondered if you still wanted to talk to me. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Kim Scott tried to take over the show. She was like, don't have Jake on anymore. She said, to be radically candid.
That guy sucks.
Jake's dumbass. That guy sucks. Yeah, the accent was pretty intense when she was saying that sort of stuff. But I stood up for you. I said, you know, we don't always have to be radically candid. Sometimes you can just be bros and just hang out and chat.
That was a good episode. That was a good episode, though. Actually, if people haven't listened to that one,
yeah,
that was a little gold nugget right there.
It was very nuggetry.
Wait a second. Sorry, I don't want to just derail the train.
No, do it.
You and I are talking on Skype right now. I can see you on video. And you just started to take off your sweatshirt.
It's getting warm.
And he's got a tank top underneath. So I can see the...
And you know what it says?
See the shoulders, and it says Santa Cruz on it, which is cool because Santa Cruz is nearby where it's not actually that close, but it's in the vicinity of San Francisco. But what's really cool is I've seen that on your profile picture somewhere.
Oh yeah,
you wearing that tank top.
It's really funny. It's like a really inappropriate Google Gmail photo.
When
I'm on sales calls with people, it's like a picture of me looking up wearing really weird sunglasses wearing this, and it looks like some weird shit's happening to me below the waist.
It's kind of like accurate.
Yeah,
I mean, I feel like always. This is the profile photo. They'll be like, oh yeah, that's kind of what John's like. Well, anyway, it was kind of cool to see it because I was like, whoa, I was starstruck. There's something when you've seen something in a photo on the screen before and then you see it in real life.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, man.
You know, it's actually funny because myself and my wife, you know, she's going to have a child very, very soon.
I did know that.
Yeah, you did know that.
But I don't know if everybody knew that who's listening.
It's almost there. I mean, it's coming out on like 12th of November. Like,
whew. That's the noise.
It's brimming. So yeah, a lot of life changes coming up, but I'm trying to give you a humble brag here, though, relating to noticing people. In the last, say, 6-7 months, people stay in like 2 areas of Berlin, Kreuzberg, Friedrichshain.
East and west?
No, that's a bit too broad.
That's the old days.
And it's been really funny every time myself and my wife go out somewhere, someone will recognize me from either these masterclass ads that are on Facebook. They'll be like, oh, you're the guy from the masterclass ads. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's me. Or the podcast. It's always one of the two of those things. Mostly it's the podcast. It's funny that it does have a very big Berlin following. Like, I think like per episode, around 500 people listen from Berlin.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really crazy.
We should say like, hello, Berlin.
Hello, Berlin.
We love you, Berlin.
But the story gets funnier. So
it's actually not funny at all so far. So it would take
that's not the
no
story. That wasn't funny. The story. Okay. I told you I was going to brag. But the funny thing is, so we were at this prenatal course and we had to introduce each other, and two of the people out of like, I think there was like 8 couples in the room, and 2 of the guys from the couples were like, ah, yeah, yeah, listen to the podcast. I was like, that's just so funny. And my wife is like, I can't go anywhere. I need to like get dressed up now because every time we go out, someone recognizes you from the podcast. I'm like, no, believe me. Believe me, you don't. This is not very professional. This is us screaming Product Breakfast Club.
They're like, oh, you dress like a slob in real life. And that's actually totally fitting with the quality of the podcast.
By the way, I don't have any problem with this, but I was in a shop pretty recently with Marina buying loads of underwear. Someone taps me on the shoulder and says, hey, are you Jonathan for the Product Breakfast Club? And I'm just there holding loads of underwear, like loads of them.
Again, totally on brand.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to be like cool. And I'm like, oh, yeah, thanks a lot for... And I'm just underwear and I still have to pay for it, you know? And that person's also behind me in the line. So I'm really, 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 really not able to handle people talking to me when I hold my underwear.
It sounds nice. That sounds nice. I am never recognized. Very rarely.
That's not true.
Which you would think that if the chances, if anyone was going to recognize somebody, it would be me as I'm tall. But it's only happened only a couple of times.
You need to be here.
But one time my family was with me, which was cool because it was on the... subway in London.
Oh, cool.
And so it really felt like, I think to them, like, oh, wow, Jake, you're a really big deal. Like somebody recognized you. And the guy was like super friendly and chatted. And like, that was like the best. But then I thought, you know, this was a couple of years ago. I thought that's going to start happening to me all the time.
All the time.
No, didn't happen.
Yeah. Me. Well, if you come to Berlin, I think you'll be recognized a lot because as you know, we use your image very easily all the time. Just like your picture everywhere.
Well, plus, I mean, you and I look a bit similar, so I figure if I get one of those Santa Cruz tank tops and just rock it, people will be like, Jonathan! So, yeah, I'm there.
Exactly. That's what's going to happen. Just get that Santa Cruz out. So, Jake, your book, it's out, right? It's landed.
Yes, it's out.
It launched.
You're listening to this the day the podcast comes out. The book comes out tomorrow, September 25th. Pre-order it right now, and Amazon will whisk it to your door.
Yeah.
Or some other bookstore. I think I'm like contractually obligated to say you can buy it from other places, but I know what you're really going to do. So it will show up on your door on Tuesday. And if it's Tuesday, it's out. Go get it.
But Jake, you know what? The pre-orders started coming early.
They did?
Yeah. So today on the Innovation Hackers Facebook group, basically a Facebook group that we run, a couple of people started posting their early pre-order arrivals.
Oh, man. Were they in the U.S.?
Let's have a look.
That is not supposed to happen. I mean, I'm glad for them. I'm glad for them, but it's actually bad news for us when that happens because we really want to make some kind of bestseller list. Would be so great. Oh. Although I don't know. I don't think our chances are as good as they were with Sprint. It's a very competitive time of year, and Sprint is so sprinty.
Yeah, Sprint is just so sweet as well.
Yeah, but if those orders start to leak out, they start to register for a different week.
Oh,
so,
no.
Publishers didn't put the hammer down. Unless they went to, I did a workshop in Austin last week. We were able to get early editions of it, early copies. And I did a talk last night in Mountain View, and we had early copies. If the people weren't there and got it, it's like contraband. But it's cool. I mean, actually, it's cool. It's cool. I'm fine. I'm dying on the inside that it happened, but don't worry.
I'm just going to mention the first person's name here. It's a guy called Fabian Beiner, and he's from Germany.
Germany. Okay. It's the UK version. Well, that's cool. That's cool. I hope that Fabian enjoys it.
Oh, he said he hates it so far.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. There's a conversation in the thread about how he got it early. And one of Germany's biggest book chains called Thalia has it in stock already for €14.
Wow. Okay. Well, there you go. Go to Thalia and pick up Make Time right now. Whatever time you get this podcast, they have it.
Yeah.
And, okay, you guys, you can seriously help me out. If you get the book, if you do get the book, if you will post an Amazon review, even if you didn't get it on Amazon, that makes a huge difference. If you liked it, if you did like the book, if you look at the Amazon reviews that are positive and upvote those, it makes a really big difference. It's actually a huge deal. And I know it's total hassle to review anything.
Do it.
But it's so, so helpful. You need to know how it is when you look at another book on Amazon. You're like, oh, geez, like two people reviewed it. I don't know.
Yeah.
So yeah, even just quantity is great. So please do that if you like the book.
Yeah. And if you want to put a little cryptic code in there, so give it a 5 out of 5 and also put a squirt emoji or a hedgehog emoji in there.
Then we'll know. Yeah, then we'll know
that you came from here and maybe we'll do something special for you.
Yeah, that's right. We could read the reviews on the podcast or something.
Exactly.
I don't know.
So yeah, Jake, that's really cool. Congrats on the book though.
Ah, thank you.
It's cool to see the journey.
The journey.
The journey. So like from pre-orders, can you kind of guess how it's going to do or is there any way to guess or?
No, I mean, okay, look, I'll just be totally candid here. I really was hoping that Make Time would make the New York Times bestseller list because Sprint did. It would be so cool. And I looked at the bestsellers in the category last week and then just looked on cross-referenced on Amazon, where do they rank in total overall sales? Very easy to see that on Amazon. And the category that we will be in with Make Time is it's like how to miscellaneous advice, cookbooks. It's like a bunch of stuff that actually sells a lot of books, unfortunately. And I was looking at the books that are in that category and it is brutal. The 10th book, which is sort of, you know, the cutoff, is already like the 100th top-selling book on Amazon out of everything. I mean, and that includes like children's books and fiction and everything. It's a super competitive category. And there's just like some really strong books in that category right now.
Yeah,
like You're a Badass is in that category. It's a huge seller, at least
what
in the
a
US.
Name. And what a name.
So yeah, so anyway, I am not optimistic that we will make the bestseller list this time, which is too bad, but it's okay. You know, can still say best-selling author. I'll still say that because of Sprint.
Hell yeah.
Like every time we've sent out a newsletter about it or we've done a talk or something, I have seen this little spike of sales. And so I think that there's a good number of people who are going to get the book in their hands. I think it's actually similar to the launch of Sprint in terms of people starting off with the book. The question is what happens after that? The only thing that can help the book continue to sell is if it works for people.
Right.
It's very much like launching a startup or launching a new product, you know, like you really don't know. You can only simulate until the book is actually in people's hands and then you find out if it works for them or not. Because I don't know about you, but like to me, how do you find out about books? Like to me, it's usually a recommendation, but what do you look anywhere else?
It's usually recommendations, I think like 90% of the time, but Amazon's recommendation engine, especially for fiction, is really good.
Oh.
So like most of the time for fiction, it's Amazon's recommendation engine. For nonfiction, it's podcasts and people basically telling me.
Yeah. Yeah. So we did a few podcast interviews, you know, and obviously I've been like definitely marketing it hard on this one, and hopefully the podcasts help, but really like ultimately so much of it comes down to word of mouth. If somebody uses it and they're like, oh yeah, this worked, I liked this, was helpful to me, helped my mindset or whatever, then they might tell their friend about it or give it as a gift or whatever. And that's really over the long term with Sprint, that's what's kept Sprint selling and kept people adopting it, was that they said, oh yeah, this works. And you know, you just don't know. So it's actually a very anxious feeling right now waiting for it to come out, because I feel like it's very plausible that for whatever reason, it won't catch with people. It won't make sense to them in the same way.
The thing about Sprint that really, really works well is that you're offering a system that people not only can have a better life with or create better products with, but it also is so nicely packaged that people can make money out of it.
That was an unforeseen thing. Yeah.
It's huge. Like since early 2017, we've been hardcore pushing Sprint. Like other companies are now hardcore pushing it. I'm like imagining that the sales must be pretty steady on that since 2016, right? Or did it just crash?
No, actually, it has reached this point. It's not like selling a bazillion copies all the time, but it has reached this steady state of just like, it's often in like the 2,000 to 3,000th spot on Amazon, which is pretty good. I mean, there's like a bazillion books on Amazon. So actually pretty strong. It basically sells a few hundred copies every week, but which is pretty good, right? Like, so just continually people are buying it and checking it out and passing it along. You know, that is an amazing success story. I don't know if that's the future for Make Time or not, but you know, as with most projects, the fun, the part that's really enjoyable is in making it. And now it's in talking about it. I gave my first talk about Make Time last night. And
how was that?
It was also nerve-wracking. I've been doing the Sprint talk. I mean, you know, because you've seen me do the Sprint talk a million times. And I've done it like a billion times. Actually, there is a little like sliver of it that comes from the Sprint talk, because there's some context with Sprint and Make Time. But to do a talk that is pretty much all new is stressful. For like, I was like, oh man, I'm so used to doing the same performance. I think it worked out pretty well. People seem to react really well. And I felt good giving it. I also am like, when I give a talk, and I'm sure you're the same way, I'm also in my mind, I'm like self-critiquing. I'm like, okay, that was not tight enough. The finish of the talk, like I needed to land it a lot tighter.
Yeah.
I had a hard time hitting that. I wanted to hit that moment when people were like,
yeah!
applauding, you know, when it was over. As I got to the end, I was like, there's just too many slides here. Like, I need to have like the big finish.
It just farted out.
So there were some things that could get better, but yeah, it felt pretty good. And it was fun. It's fun to do something challenging. I guess the thing that's exciting for me about writing books is to do something that's really hard and not know where it's going to go. Not know like if it's going to work or not. Not know if you can do it. I don't know if we could write like a self-help book for time and attention management. We tried. It was fun to try to do something hard. We'll see what happens. Try to market it to people. Try to talk about it and explain it. If it doesn't work, hey, I can't wait to get back to the science fiction book. That's going to be super hard. Maybe I'll fail at that too. But it's more fun for me than doing kind of the same thing over and over.
Yeah. It's really cool. Really, really cool. I mean, it's obviously something that I think a lot of people want to write books, but when they actually sit down to do even an article, they can't even manage to pop one out. So it's something that someone like me, as a violent extrovert, to even sit down to do this podcast is like a little bit like a bit intense for me, right? Now I'm like, oh, I'd actually like to go out and play in the mud for a minute.
Feel free. Yeah, let's okay. just mic you
Bye.
Up.
It's just like for 30 minutes and people would still be like, yeah, it was a good episode, actually. I love that bit where you were in the mud pit. It's good. But that's really, really cool. Actually, we're having a make time week next week at AJ and Smart. And so every day, so this is where all the sales are going to be.
Yeah, all AJ and Smart. Just Jonathan's employees forced to buy me.
Read it. Read it. We're doing every single day of the week next week on Instagram. Actually, this week, if you're listening to it, will be make time week. So on our Instagram at AJ Smart Design, on our YouTube channel, we're going to be doing a crap ton of make time posts and kind of videos and chats and stuff like that and streams. So yeah, maybe we should do something if we can get a big enough crowd together, like maybe 100 people or maybe a little bit more. Maybe you could do like a live class version of your talk that you gave at Mountain View.
That'd be cool. Yeah, yeah. We should try to do it. You mean on the internet?
On the internet.
Ah, yeah, we could do that. I'm going to be doing that talk a few more times and trying to fix the stuff hone that it. I think can get better. Hone it.
Yeah.
Hone it. So that'd be a good way to hone it.
Jake, I'm not like that. It's not like that. You know I'm not like that, Jake. I do my talk and then I discard it and I start a new one for the next thing I do.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You and I have a different approach.
Yeah.
That's right. Because my approach is I do the same talk and I'm going to like keep doing it over and over again and try to make it like as good as possible. And like, I was thinking of it as if I am a pop star or a
Beyonce.
Band. Like I'm in a band and I'm going to perform the same songs and concert over and over again and try to make them better and better. But your approach is like make it fresh every time. Which is wrong, but it's
wrong,
interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you do it that way?
So, because for me, I have to be entertained. So last week, for example, I went to Manchester. Also, hello, Manchester. A lot of listeners there, which was really cool.
Manchester! Love you!
Fucking Manchester! All right, Manchester! And it could have been 65 people. And it was just me giving a talk, which was really nice. And maybe 1.5 hours beforehand, I was like, okay, I think I'll talk about this idea. Like, it's more like triggers for things I want to talk about. So the slides are often not even used.
Oh, interesting.
And so I like started with like one slide that triggered me to talk about one thing. And then I asked the CEO, could he give me a flip chart so I could draw some stuff out that I was kind of trying to get across to people. And then I actually, in the end, I was like, you guys probably just want to see what our sales deck looks like, don't you? And they're all like, yeah. And so I just like looked through Dropbox for like 2 minutes till I found the sales deck. And then I went through that.
That's cool.
And then I decided that the last 30 minutes should just be Q&A. And I think it was like one of the best receptions I've ever gotten at any talk. And I did something similar for a conference that I did recently as well. I was just like, okay, this is my most popular Medium article. So that will be like the core of my talk. But I'm going to see if we can somehow do a Q&A. And this was like maybe a 300 person audience. This was actually quite cool. And the people at the conference couldn't get it to work that they could hand the microphone into the audience. They just could not get that working. And so I just asked the audience members to scream the questions to me. And it was really funny, really fun. And it was just like really great energy. I don't know what my problem is, but if I'm not entertained, I'm not doing it. Like if I'm not personally entertained,
yes, it has to be fun, right?
Yeah, it has to be fun and it has to be new. Or, and that's a funny thing, like, I guess it's when we're really honest on this podcast, but sometimes I'm worried that I come across arrogant.
But you are arrogant. I mean, that's honest.
Yeah, I'm
you're
a piece
arrogant,
of shit.
So
yeah.
Now people know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm an absolute piece of shit. So
at the end of the Kim Scott interview, it was so funny. You teed up the interview and then this is a nice interview with Kim Scott. She's, Kim Scott is like a very like professional,
yes,
big deal.
Yes.
We were just talking about book rankings. Her book is crushing it. It's been out for like couple years, or maybe not quite that long, but it's still like right at the top of the list.
So
it's
just, fucking good.
It's so good and so successful. And she's just like, right, she's answering those questions, telling those great stories, so crisp and professional. At the end, you come back in to close it with the recording and you're just like, oh man, that shit was good. That was some, just like, it was like dropping all these little S words.
That's great.
I was laughing. I was listening to that on my headphones on my run and I was just cracking up. I was like, Jonathan just like comes in and it's like Waldorf and Statler in the back of the Muppets. Just like, rah, rah, rah.
That's so great. Good, man. I didn't even notice that.
Sorry, tangent over. But back to you. Bring the arrogance.
It's good to have a ramble chat. We haven't had one in a while. So a couple of episodes back, maybe 15 episodes back, we did an episode called Design Conferences Suck. Since recording that episode, I've never gotten so many conference requests in my entire life. And the last time you and I met, I had gotten a conference request. And I'm just saying this straight out, whatever. I know it doesn't sound great. But like, Jake, I don't really necessarily want to do these conferences,
yeah,
right? I don't love it. I don't like the idea that they want to know like what slides I'm going to use. I don't like preparing. It makes me really nervous as well. I don't prepare, but I also feel nervous. Like I feel sick before I have to go on stage because I don't have a presentation. And you were just like, make it so expensive that it doesn't matter.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, that's right. That's a strategy. Like, ask them to pay you so much money that if they do pay you, you'll be like, well, okay, yeah. I guess all of the bad things are worth it.
Yeah. Jake, it's working.
It's working?
Yeah.
It's working in the sense that now they don't ask or that they're offering you the money.
No, they always say no at the start. There are like two people listening to this podcast who are sorry. You know how the game is, and I'm being honest. So I say no, but this is the number. And they said, oh, yeah, like no chance at all. Like, you know, we don't even pay our speakers. And I was like, cool, yeah, like, I mean, but I can recommend someone else. And then like a week later, I got a message saying like, how about like this much? And I was like, no. And then like, how about this much? And I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, it's honestly not worth my time as a CEO to take a day or 2 days off. In those 2 days, I can make that much money back for the company and more. So yeah, like two conferences in the last, like, let's say month have kind of been fine. Well, some back and forth have just been like, yeah, okay, let's just do that. So I've gone from not getting paid to speak or not even getting paid for the travel costs to getting all the travel costs paid and getting the target is 25,000 euro for a talk. And that could be a talk or like a 3-hour workshop. I have not gotten exactly 25,000 euro yet. Or wait, I should say, I haven't been able to get it for like a 1-hour talk yet for a one-off thing. But yeah, like I wasn't even expecting to get kind of close to it. But the other thing is that I'm also not going to do the talk unless I get it. So I'm going to like put a lot of effort into it when I actually do it. So yeah, it's really cool now. I'm doing less talks. I'm actually getting paid for them. They don't feel like a burden now that I'm actually getting a real amount of money for it.
Well, you know, this is certainly like a weird situation to be in and not the situation that I was in when I started doing talks. Because when you start off doing talks, many of the folks who speak at conferences are in the situation, you may have something really great to say, but if you know, don't have an audience yet or sort of a track record of doing talks, then it's maybe not something that the conference can sell. You know, there's a book that I wrote.
It's called Sprint.
That you wrote. It's called Sprint.
Buy it.
Buy Sprint. No, it's a different book. It's called Make Time. I love it. No, it's a different book. It's called Confessions of a Public Speaker by Scott Berkin. It's really good. He's an excellent public speaker who I've seen many times and really just one of the few speakers. Like every time I see him, he's doing a different talk. And he always is just great. Even if I'm not interested in the topic, as he speaks on different topics, he does a great job. And what's cool about this book, he's like talking about some practicalities about giving talks, but a lot of it is about things like how you prepare, how you wing it when things don't go well, how to deal with different situations, and a lot of the realities of being a speaker who's paid. And also the fact that like those numbers, like that figure, the idea of like having the target be 25,000 euro, it sounds insane.
Yeah.
But as he puts in the book, he's like, look, there are not many people who the conferences can get to show up who are on topic and will draw the audience. Because you've got tons of people at a conference, you know, they want to sell tickets to show up. And so there is actually a value in that. It's an interesting situation once you're in a place like you are where people know who you are and you have an audience and you are a really compelling, charismatic speaker, that the kinds of talks where the organizer has to pay you, they're going to make the talk better for you. It's going to be a better event for you. And this is something when I got a speaking agent, because I was like, oh, well, maybe it makes sense to be doing more free talks and just kind of build up the audience. It's not that that's not a good strategy, I think. It really can be. But he said, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that when they pay, people will show up. Like the organizers are going to be motivated to make sure people show up.
Yeah.
They're going to talk about you. You're going to have a key spot. You know, you're going to have a good spot. Like you're going to have a lot of attention. You're going to have a full room. And all of those things make a big difference. It makes for a more effective talk. So it's just one of those things like when you negotiate, you're also saying like, I'm more valuable. My time is more valuable. And this goes for any kind of negotiating.
Yeah.
And when that value proposition is higher for both sides, a lot of times the outcome is actually better. So
it's true because honestly, in a lot of cases where I've done free talks, the talk itself, I have fun in like in the very moment, I'm like, oh, that was fun. But before and after, I'm like, ugh, I shouldn't do that anymore. It's a waste of time. Like I'm being taken advantage of. Like I clearly, I put a huge amount of energy. Like when I'm on the stage, I'm loud, I'm exciting, I'm making loads of jokes. I put a lot of effort into it. I see a lot of the people speaking before me or after me who might be getting paid who are just like, here's our portfolio for the last 2 years and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, God damn it. Give me money. I'll do it better.
One of the funny things about those talks is that this is not my insight. This is Scott Birkin from Confessions of a Public Speaker. But he talks about how they want to see a famous person talk or a person who has like a job or like a big shot, a big company, like a big shot at a big company or like whatever. They also, people happen to enjoy watching people talk who are good at speaking, but they won't necessarily just like pay for like a person they've never heard of who's good at speaking. People will totally show up to watch the talk by the person at the conference who's sort of famous or sort of has this cool job. Even if the talk is terrible, like everybody wants to see it. It's a weird thing where like it's very hard to actually get rewarded for your talks being very compelling. But I know you're like this and I'm like this. Like I want it to be a great experience for the audience. It has to be. It doesn't matter. I'm surprised that you don't feel good afterwards. I usually, before the talk, I'm like, oh my God. But then when I do it, I feel good. And then like after it's over, I'm like, it usually gives me
I actually do feel good afterwards. Like the adrenaline rush and people clapping and stuff. And it's more that I'm like, now I'm in a different country and I have to make my way home. And, you know, now we started doing these web classes, like these kind of basically like online classes where people can join at a specific time. I kind of expend the same amount of energy, but it's just so much fun and I can really fuck around. The thing about conferences as well is just this stuff where everything's broken. Oh, sorry, the clicker is broken. Oh, sorry, everything's broken. Sort yourself out.
Oh, yeah. So you and I are at a state, which is a really great state. And there are lots of people who are bigger, big shots than us. But we are at a state where we can ask people to pay us to talk.
Yeah, we're baby shots, but people pay us.
We got to talk. We're baby shots. But we got to talk about when you're like an embryo shot or like a fetus shot, like how to get to be a baby shot for a second. But one thing, before we get into the shot, we got to talk about when you go to an event. If you're going to be a speaker, you have to have your own remote. You have to have your own connectors. You got to bring all the connectors yourself. You got to bring your own power supply.
Yeah.
Have the presentation on your laptop. You also have the USB key. You got to have everything because everything will go wrong.
Yes.
Maybe two things will go wrong unless they're just like really, really on it. But even a lot of people who are on it, something will go wrong.
Yeah.
And you got to be prepared. And this is from Confessions of a Public Speaker. And this happened to me one time. You got to be prepared to give your talk with no slides at all.
That has happened to me as well.
And if you do that, like I was in this situation, I'm in Seoul in South Korea and the slides just didn't work. And there's this whole crowd of people and they have live translations. Oh. So everybody's got on the headsets and it's like a theater seating, you know, it's like an amphitheater, like the ramp goes up, you know, and I'm down on the stage and I got nothing. I got nothing to show them. And everybody's like waiting for me with their headsets. And so I'm like, okay, well, I've done this talk before. I know this talk. I'm just going to give it. I'm just going to like try to almost like act out the slides and tell the story. And I really think that was one of the best talks that I ever gave. Like, I think having to do it and just like lock in and give it without the slides actually, I think, made it more engaging and more compelling and made me a better speaker afterward. In fact, in the talk I gave last night, I'm experimenting with having parts of it that don't have slides at all, that are just stories, you know, with a black slide. If you get to the point where you know that you have all of the devices that you need and you know you can do the presentation if need be without the slides, a lot of the worst stress of going on, well, not the worst. I guess it's always stressful right before.
Especially if you're me.
Yeah. Anyway, but let's talk about getting started giving presentations because I didn't do it for the first maybe when I was at Microsoft, basically, I didn't ever give presentations, maybe once or twice. So the first time I started to give presentations, I was in my late 20s when I started working at Google, and we had to do it. We had teams that were in different locations. There was more occasion to give a presentation to another team that we might be working with because there was more interconnection between the teams than there was at Microsoft. And there was more like video calls where it helped to just sort of conduct the conversation to have a slide deck. When I started working at Google, and so again, I'm like, I'm almost like 10 years into my career because I started working, doing professional design when I was like maybe 19 or 20. I was like, okay, I really want to get good at this. And I just read like every book I could about presentations and storytelling. Presentations became a big part of what enabled me to do everything from there on out. Like launch products, get people to understand the design and buy in on the design decisions. Eventually sell the design sprint to people, like explain it to people, get them excited about it, pitch the book, you know, and now I'm using it with MakeTime. If you can like go way into it, designers have an advantage because, you know, we understand visual communication. And if you can also start to understand spoken communication and storytelling and put those things together, it can be very powerful. Presentations are usually something people hate, and there's a huge opportunity to do it well. For me, it's been something I was working on for years and years and years. And it really sort of, as I started to get good at it and more comfortable with it, it started to really boost and make everything else sort of possible.
It's actually a really good point, and I've honestly never thought about it. But if I think about my trajectory of going from starting out as a designer to where I am today, a huge amount of it is the ability to pitch things to people and explain things to people in a way that gets them excited, is also clear enough that they actually get what you're talking about and don't switch off and fall asleep. I mean, my approach to it, now that you've told me about Confessions of a Sexy Man, what was it called again?
Confessions of a Sexy Man. That's it.
Okay. What was it called?
It's called Confessions of a Public Speaker.
Cool. So Confessions of a Public Speaker, that's something I'll definitely read. But so here's the thing. I actually spent most of my teenage years on the stage as a performer, as a singer.
Yeah.
And my co-founder, Michael, was the exact same, right? So both of us are used to and actually crave that sort of attention.
Yeah.
We thrive on it. So like when I walk out onto the stage and a load of people are looking at me and they don't know who I am and like, oh, okay, here's another talk. It excites the shit out of me that I get to entertain these people. So for me, it's always been about entertainment. I think I'm able to lean so heavily on that and I'm kind of able to sell things to people and pitch things to people in a way that excites them, that I'm really then completely ignoring the building of the story and the construction of it and like the technical part.
Yeah, but the entertainment, it has to actually be the core of it.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It feels wrong because if you're serious, we're doing serious work.
Yeah.
I'm thinking right now of myself, like working at Google. For example, one of the first things I did at Google was to design an emoji menu to go into chat in Gmail.
Ooh.
And Gmail itself as well. And so this sounds like really obvious now because emojis are everywhere, but it's actually really controversial in Google at the time because the culture was not like so happy-go-lucky and fun. They took those products really seriously.
Right.
And they didn't want to make it sort of spammy, lots of bells and whistles, kind of, you know, like it was, everything was meant to be like a serious, powerful tool. And so if I imagine myself in that scenario or as the products and the things I was working on there, that was sort of my starter project. But things that got more complex working on Gmail or sort of when we were creating Hangouts, a lot of these things were about the fundamental thing was serious. I'm trying to convince you or trying to explain why we're making these design decisions, these product decisions, and what we're up to or what the status is of engineering or whatever. But if you don't do that in an entertaining way, like people will get the information, but they'll switch off. If you entertain people, if you get people especially to laugh, then their mind opens to the story and the logic and, you know, the structure behind it. But you have to actually take the entertainment really seriously.
Yes.
Listen, people who are listening to this podcast, like, I think this is especially true of designers. It's probably true in many different fields, but especially true of designers that I think we are very obsessed with the idea of getting to be really good designers and really respect people who are like at the top of their game and amazing designers. You and I are probably not the best designers that we know.
Oh, actually, I am. No, I'm the best.
I mean, I know so many designers better than me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So many. But the reason why anybody listens to us or thinks we know what we're talking is because we have focused on the entertainment and the storytelling part of
it.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that we don't know anything about building products and design. We do. But that other part sincerely is important. And it took me a long time to realize that anything mattered besides the craft. The rest of it is part of it too.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge thing. And we don't have values, principles, whatever they are, but we're actually starting to work at them at AJ and Smart now. Mission, principles, and whatever. You know what I'm talking about. The things that company writes down in a book and then people are like, oh, that's our values. But for us, definitely entertainment is a huge, huge factor in the success of AJ and Smart, my personal success. Honestly, the success of this podcast, you know, when people talk about this podcast, they don't talk about the great content that they heard and the things that they learned. Sometimes they do when there's a guest, I guess. But when it's you and I, we are consciously wanting this to be an entertaining show. Yesterday, okay, little shout out to Jonathan who stopped me on the street yesterday. And Jonathan and another guy. Sorry about the other guy. And I know I met you and I know you listened to the podcast and I'm sorry. But what he said was, what's great about listening to that podcast is that it's fun.
I think good advice for anybody who's going to like meet me or you is to change your name to our name.
Yeah, exactly. We'll remember that then. Yeah.
Because Jonathan, you remember Jonathan. Yeah. Change your name to Jake. I'll definitely remember.
Actually, my wife was with me again and she said, you know, all the people who listen to your podcast look exactly like you. And that guy's name was actually Jonathan. So one of the guys said, like, one of the reasons or the reason I'm listening to this is because it's entertaining and a lot of the design podcasts take themselves too seriously. And I'm just like, that's the biggest compliment you can give me.
It's true.
It is so important. Yeah. And it's so like, I listen back to this sometimes and I'm like, this is just funny. It's so silly and it's just like easy to listen to. And you can just listen to it. You can just have it like laying in the background and you can kind of enjoy it. But you know what? Let's not tell people this because it's such a competitive advantage to be That's entertaining. Right. Yeah, don't tell. Be serious. Be serious as fuck.
Well, the other thing is with trying to be entertaining and doing a presentation at work or whatever it might be, you know, in the podcast, whatever. It's like work should be fun if it can be fun.
Yeah.
It's still your life. This is still like part of our life recording this podcast. Like being serious and buttoned up and like that just wouldn't feel right. Like why add something onerous into our lives? You know, if you want to teach people, make it fun, make it easy for them.
What are we teaching people?
I don't actually, yeah. That's my advice for other people who have something to teach. You don't actually have any real content.
Oh, I read a book, by the way, and I want to recommend it.
Oh, okay. Oh, I've got a series too. Yeah. Go.
By
go,
the
go.
Way, did you notice the segue, how good that was?
It was, yeah. It
literally
was.
No segue. I just said, I have a book.
No, there was a good one though, because you were like, ah,
yeah.
I have a book.
Oh, yeah.
So the laugh was good. The laugh made me feel like we were still on the same page. And then you did a 90-degree turn.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, before the podcast, Jake gave me some radically candid feedback on my interview style.
Yeah, should we reenact it?
Okay.
Oh, hey, Jonathan. Hey. Oh, hey, I listened to the interview you did with Kim Scott. That was really great.
Yeah, I nailed it. There was no possible way to improve the technique though, right?
Yeah. Oh, I felt like you did a really nice job with, I know you were pressed for time in it because there was only 20 minutes on Kim's schedule that day when you recorded it. You did a really nice job of, in those sort of under duress, letting Kim tell those stories. She's so good at telling those stories. And then also doing this sort of intervening comments where you related it to your work as a guy running a design agency and experiences you've had, which I feel like really helps our audience. So really nice job with that. I do want to give you some radically candid feedback about your interviews. May I give you some?
Only if it's radically candid.
Oh, it's okay. So after somebody gives an answer, when you're doing an interview, I think you do a better job with the transition. So afterwards, a lot of times you'll say, ah, that's great. And I feel like it sounds like, I know that you're listening to them. And I know that doing interviews is really stressful, but it sounds like you were just sort of waiting for them to finish so you could ask your next question.
Yeah.
So I think that that would be a place to improve. And unfortunately, because I'm not an expert in interviewing myself, I definitely am waiting for the other person to stop talking so I can have my turn. I don't know what to tell you to do, but maybe you could listen to some podcast interviewers who you really like and take note of how they make the transition.
Oh, thanks a lot for that piece of radically candid feedback, Jake. I've got some for you as well. Shut the fuck up, boy. No, but it's really true. Like for anyone who listens to the podcast when we have a guest on, I always am so nervous that I'm not listening to what they're saying. It's true. I can't hear them. All I can hear is, oh God, I hope I don't ask a stupid question. And I interviewed Scott Belsky last week. That should come out next week. I felt like I did that even worse. The transitions were even worse. So Scott will be like, and this is how I became the VP of a product at Adobe. And I'm like, oh yeah, great. So what car do you like? It was so unsmooth and I could feel it. But I also, I don't know, I just, after the Scott Belsky interview, by the way, he was amazing. I was just like, yeah, not interviewing people anymore. It's too, like this conversation that we're having now is fun because it's like back and forth and back and forth. There's basically no breaks at all. In the interview with Scott and in the interview with Kim, I have to think of transitions. I have to think because I don't know them and I can't have a conversation. It's not like Joe Rogan where I'm sitting with them and I have like 3 hours to get them stoned and chat to them. It's just like they don't care who I am. And they're like, hello, who are you? And I'm like, hey, I got to get some questions out of you as fast as possible. And yeah, Scott had just come from, I was looking at his Instagram and it's like, hey, I'm at Gary Vee's office. And I was like, oh shit, like he's on Gary Vee's podcast. That's already going to like put up the game. And then like 20 minutes later, it's like, hey, I'm on Tim Ferriss. And I was like, no.
Oh man.
No, Tim Ferriss. And then straight onto Product Breakfast Club. Oh, Jesus.
In the same breath with Tim Ferriss and Gary Vee, Product Breakfast
Club. Same amount of listeners.
He wanted to warm up, man. He just wanted to warm up. He wanted to be ready for the Jonathan Thunder. It's interesting interview podcasts when you listen to them, I wonder, a lot of it is the host's ability to get people on there because mostly you want to hear the person talk, right? Like a lot of it actually is listening to the person talk. And if you can get the right people on the show, And to a certain extent, if you could just get them talking, like that's sort of the key. I guess the people who are really masterful at it, I think Tim Ferriss is really good. Like, I think he's very intentional and studious in the way he's approached interviewing, or someone like Terry Gross, really good. I suppose they draw things out. They're analyzing what's being said at the time. But it's a weird thing for us because the goal of this podcast is not to have it be an interview podcast. You and I were talking a little bit before we started, like, is it worthwhile? We get a listenership boost when we bring on guests, but it's also not like the thing that's the most fun for us to do.
The Jason Fried episode, for example, that was the first one where we brought a guest on. That was super stressful for me, and I think stressful for you as well.
Totally.
It's that feeling every time. And I know you always, every time you go through something stressful like that, you go over like a hump and you're like, oh my God, I've made it through. And now I've like come out the other side.
Yeah. Actually, even when I think about it, I get stressed again, like residual. I know my voice was like in a higher register when you're interviewing. Oh, hi, Jason.
Jason. Kiss me. He's like, what? Why are you saying kiss me? I think it's just too stressful. I think we should just have more listeners to just us chatting. And therefore, every listener listening right now, please give it a 5-star review and share it with a friend, please. We will wait.
Yeah, you're required to invite 3 people and force them to listen every week. That's how we're going to grow.
Explain to them that it is very fun and good fun times.
Good fun times.
So let me quickly tell you about this book. It's called Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs. But actually the book, look at this cover. So the book is called Creative Selection, Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs by Ken Koscienda, I think his name is.
Your cover is really weird. I'm going to look up the American cover.
This is so bad. The American cover, the hardcover one is this blue one, which is still ugly. Whatever, it doesn't matter, okay? So what I found really interesting about this book, and it comes back to Sprint, and it comes back to how we're selling Sprints at AJ and Smart, and something that I think could be a new amendment to the design sprint, especially when it comes to selling it, especially when it comes to running these at companies, basically how it is in real life day to day now.
Oh.
So let me quickly tell you about the book. The book is about an Apple engineer who was at Apple for 15 years. He was actually the main person who worked on the keyboard for the very first iPhone, which was a huge deal. He was also the guy who worked on Safari, the very first version of it for Mac. And he was presenting directly to Steve Jobs. So he was kind of someone who worked his way up in Apple and had very high access. And this book is like an incredibly nerdy account of working those 15 years at Apple. Seriously detailed account.
Which sounds fascinating. That sounds like it would be fascinating.
It is. Yeah. Okay. If you're not into product development or product management, this book will kill you with boredom. Look at this page. It's just code. It like he's literally showing like the code.
It's literally the code. It's a whole page. Which is cool though. That's like an illustration though, right? That's just like, hey, check the code.
Yeah, kind of. But it's a 280 page book, and probably around 100 pages of those are just about how he developed and designed the keyboard for the iPhone. And the stories of going back and forth between Scott Forstall and Steve Jobs and stuff like that. And what I found interesting is that the point of the book, I guess, it's hard to tell the point of it because it's just very nerdy, very granular, doesn't have a very clear overarching theme. But I think the point is that the culture of Apple when Steve Jobs was there was all about demos. The core of the book is that something people may not know about Apple is that the entire culture of product design and development was demos, and it was gut feeling rather than testing. So he very explicitly says, we would create a demo based on what we thought would be cool and interesting, and then we would go to Steve Jobs and he would say whether he likes it or not, and then it would go into the actual product and get launched. And this was, for me, this kind of was like, that's something you and I have been preaching for a while, that sometimes this gut feeling approach does actually work. And the sprint process is just about creating this prototype so that it can give you a better gut feeling. And it seems like Apple's process, at least around the Steve Jobs era, was all about, okay, keyboard, let's spend like a week or two on it. Okay, now let's bring this to Steve. And now Steve says, no, I don't like it. Okay, let's go back and let's try something else. So he's like the single user tester. And I found it really interesting that these huge, popular, crazy products like the iPhone, at least according to this book, nobody ever saw it outside of Apple before it launched. Like people were not allowed to use it. There were no testers. It was purely based on taste. It was purely based on their taste and their gut feeling. And that's how they brought products to the market. So two things for me that were really interesting there. Number one, I feel like calling in the sprint book the fourth day is prototype, right?
Mm-hmm. We can say the fourth step since that's easier for you with your with your condensed sprint. Yeah.
The fourth step is prototype. And in the industry, prototypes are often seen as, even though they are just things that, of course, they're never considered to be the final product, prototypes can be confused with something that could be handed over to a developer and turned into a real product and kind of like just made into something real. And a lot of companies, they see prototypes as like something that's quite far down the line. Whereas we've been experimenting, honestly, since I read this book, we've been experimenting on the calls and with the work with clients, just calling that day demo, as in we're creating a demo for the users. And we're not creating a prototype. In the end, it's the exact same thing, but we are creating a demo. And what this seems to have done is, rather than these companies really getting OCD about every little element that's in there and like obsessing about the back button, and sometimes it's difficult, especially in Silicon Valley, to pull them away from these things.
Yeah.
It's about what you actually intended, and it's about testing the big idea, testing these big things and seeing if it's the right feeling and if they get the right gut feeling. I'm not changing this in the Sprint 2.0 literature, but I just want to know what you thought about that, about the wording from prototype to demo.
Well, I think it's fascinating because the words are really important. And I've never thought about that idea of what the word demo means to people, but it could be closer to the mindset we want people to have with prototype. And maybe I'm really primed because you were just describing how the way Apple works.
I primed you.
Yeah, but like, I mean, a demo is this thing that it looks like the thing. It's a demonstration of the thing, right? Whereas a prototype, you're right. Like a lot of people's conception of prototype is it's a proof of concept. It could be a code prototype. And usually in the companies I'm used to working with building software products, it's much more sophisticated than what we're talking about. It's something that takes a long time to build and has some level of technical sophistication, usually. I mean, I think that's a compelling idea. If nothing else, it's a useful word for people to have in their pocket when they're talking about prototyping with a team to say, now you might be familiar with a prototype being this or that. We're talking more about like a demo. It's going to be a demo that the customer's going to see. I mean, vocabulary is really interesting and it's worth nerding out about because it has this powerful effect on how people understand what you're doing. A demo has the risk of sounding like it's more of a presentation. It's more of a, we're going to sell you on it with this demo.
Yeah.
A demo does sound perhaps like I'm selling it to you. And it's very important that when the customer looks at the product on Friday, unless what you're testing is marketing it and having a sales conversation, in 99% of the situations, you're not selling them. You're not pitching them on it. You're just letting the demo or the prototype stand on its own. So that's like maybe the risk. But yeah, I think it's a really worthwhile thing to consider. And especially knowing your team and maybe even using those two words to push what they think. It's cool.
It's just a thought.
Yeah. I want to play with it a little bit, actually. I'm going to mention it the next time. I'm doing a workshop tomorrow, and I will mention that then alongside prototype. I think that this whole idea of how do you make a good decision about a product, it's something that probably got, for me, more thought and more tinkering than anything else in the design sprint process, was how do you get a good decision? And it's funny because I think that on the surface, it might sound as if the design sprint approach is very different from what Apple did, because Apple was saying, we're not going to test with our customers. We're going to trust our own judgment. And that's true, because we are saying in a design sprint, you finish by testing with your customers. That's what happens on Friday or on the last day of your sprint, whatever day of the week it might be. But fundamentally, actually, what we were doing was trying to help the deciders at these startups, the CEOs or whoever it might be, make the best decision possible. So how do you do that? I mean, at Apple, they've got Steve Jobs and he's really special. Like a lot of people think that maybe we should just craft our company in the image of Apple and like the leaders, whether it's a product manager, CEO is like, I'm going to be the Steve Jobs of this company.
Yeah.
Pretty much nobody has that kind of product judgment, right? And like, that's pretty unique to have someone you can show it to who just says like, yeah, like this is going to work. And he made so many good product calls. By the time they did the iPhone, he had so much experience building products. Like, it's also like he's at a level, even as Steve Jobs himself, like that's not Steve Jobs level 1. That's like Steve Jobs level 20, like after he had done all these different things. So to try to actually have a single decider who's that omniscient is really hard. You're probably not going to get that. But there's something really valuable about having a super powerful decider, because things get more opinionated. Things are more likely to be different than what your competitors are doing. And if they're different, there's a greater chance they're going to be wildly successful. So in the sprint, everything is geared towards opinionated decisions. That's why we don't collaborate when we're coming up with solutions. Instead, everybody's working almost against each other, working on their own, because we want those solutions to compete. And one thing that really inspired me, both on having those things compete in doing like battle royale style testing, where you build two or three competing prototypes, is a story from Apple about when they were developing the iPhone and they had two teams build competing versions. They had sort of the iPod-based version, and then they had more of the sort of touchscreen, like the iOS version, that is the one that ultimately won. And that idea of having internal competition is really interesting. And then a lot of the decision-making, it puts the decider in the situation where they get to choose among these opinionated directions. But we're not relying on the decider being Steve Jobs-like and having perfect judgment. Part of the idea too is that by getting the decider to then watch what happens when they're testing with customers, you improve their insight about what works well with customers. We assume that they have a lot of insight already, and we assume the best and give them a lot of authority to make decisions and to make opinionated decisions unilaterally. But then we also say, like, okay, we're gonna give you a quick feedback loop so you can get better and better and better at this. So hopefully you can get closer to that level where maybe at a certain level, people don't need to do the testing anymore. But almost nobody is at that point now, you know? And so anyway, I think it's interesting. And I think that it's actually very compatible. Like, what made Apple successful, I think, is compatible with the way I think about building products.
I think so too. I think for me, what was surprising about it was how well it aligned with how we're running sprints and how the sprint is kind of explained. It is a lot of gut feeling, a lot of assumptions, a lot of just kind of experimenting, throwing stuff around, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't. And super quickly with this book, I think it's definitely worth reading if you're in the product world. Just don't expect it to be like super well written. Or I did have to skip one chapter where it was going into the literal coding of Safari. So like going into the code and showing how they displayed, you can see that here. I mean, it took like 1,000 words to get to how they displayed this box here. So I was getting a little bit impatient and I skipped that. But I kind of, the story about the iPhone, of how janky it all was to pull that together. It was like a hallway full of engineers and designers just shooting shit together. And it was this guy, Ben something. Anyway, there was like a lead designer on it. And what he was doing all day was just like putting together fun animations. And he was like, oh, this could be cool. And then, you know, they would work on it and then they would show it to Steve. And then he would be really mean to Ken. And it's like, it's hilarious as well. Like, it's hilarious. Like, there's no resolution, but he's like, even though I met Steve like 3 times, he didn't recognize me anymore, doesn't remember my name, and very dismissive and didn't bother looking at me. And they call him the Oracle as well, because they would go to him with these demos and he would just be like, this one, this one, this one. So yeah, it's really, really interesting, the book. I think it's worth reading. And what's interesting actually is that at the end of this book, this developer says he left. And the main reason was because the process of bringing products out changed so much when Steve Jobs died that it just wasn't interesting to him anymore. Even though I know, at least from some people, I know that Apple are still not super into testing. I know that they're not super into, actually not even that much into post-its at all, or very much, they're very insular in the way that they bring their products out. But they are actually starting to get a little bit more open with how they're doing that. So that's going to be interesting over the next few years to see how that all starts to work.
They're going to start doing design sprints and then it's all going to fall apart. The whole business
Exactly. The iPhone is just going to come out really wet one year. It's like going to be full of water. And it's like, sorry, that was because we did the prototype a little bit too fast. Are you buying anything from the new Apple event?
Yeah, I am.
What are you getting?
I'm going to get the new iPhone, the big one.
The XS Max.
The XS Max. Yeah.
Oh, fancy.
I did pre-order it. Like, it hasn't shipped yet. So I still, as we're talking right now, I had a flash yesterday of, you know what, I'm going to downgrade. I'm going to get like a refurbished iPhone 7 in black.
Really?
Well, that's a thought I had because I missed the button. We talked last time. I still miss that button.
You're wrong.
Yeah. What about you? Anything tempt you?
I think it's always the little fucking cutie Apple Watch.
The watch with that bigger screen.
Yeah, the watch. bigger screen. Like for me, the idea of being able to leave home without my phone, but still be contactable.
I do like that idea too. I've been tempted by the watch. In the morning, I take my son to school and I run home. It'd be nice to listen to this podcast. I could listen to this podcast on the phone, on the watch, I mean.
So that's the thing. To be honest, I don't need anything they released. And it was exactly as I expected. People were very bored by the conference and complaining that Apple's doomed because they didn't release anything new. And it was exactly as we thought, but it doesn't really matter. I think Apple just knows what they're doing. iOS 12 is actually kind of a nice update, I have to say. Just really quickly, it's after speeding up my phone, it sped up all my devices for the first time ever. Like an iOS update that just speeds everything up and cleans things up. So less gimmicks this year, which has been very nice.
There's a funny little Irish thing that you just said that I've wondered about. What? And I'm going to ask you about it now. You said it's after speeding up my phone.
Oh my God.
What does that
So many people point that out.
Oh, really? Okay. What does it mean? Does it mean already?
What did I actually say?
I think you said it's after speeding up my phone.
It's after speeding up my phone. It's an Irish thing. It might even be a South Irish thing. I guess it means it has just come out.
Okay.
Yeah. And in Ireland, for some reason, we sometimes say it's after coming out. I don't know why. I don't know. And even though like my accent has gone, like I've been in this country for so many years now, like 10 years in Germany, I still say it's after something or she's after coming over. And there's so many weird things. Like it's weird.
I like it. I like the weirdness. So don't correct it on my account.
I can't change it. I somehow can't change that one, but it's in now. It's in. It's in. Cool, Jake. You know what? I didn't even get to the topic that I was going to chat about today.
Don't give it away. We'll save it for
next
time.
Okay, I won't.
We'll save it for next time.
I think this has been one of my favorite episodes so far, but I don't know what to call it. I'm thinking big product decisions, gut feeling, or test.
That's good. We also talked about presentations a lot.
Yeah, so but I don't know how to make an interesting.
How to make that
can
sound
you think
good.
Of it? Clickbaity.
How to make 25,000 euros speaking.
Yeah.
Or decide like Steve Jobs. I don't know.
People don't like the Steve Jobs thing anymore.
Not good anymore.
That would never have happened if Steve Jobs was still alive. What? What wouldn't have happened? The clickbaity title. Don't worry, I'll come up with a clickbaity one.
Okay.
But it's funny that the titles are so, so important. Yeah.
Also, if you're listening to the podcast, for God's sake, give us a 5-star review.
Please.
It only takes a second. I mean, you don't even have to type anything. You can just tap 5 stars. I'm actually angry that you haven't done it. So, so helpful.
We could be getting paid $25,000 for this.
I know. Oh, man.
What are we doing?
It's all the reviews.
It's fun, though. Thanks a lot for all your lovely messages. I'm talking to the audience now, not you.
Oh, because I've been texting you while we were talking. Yeah. I thought it was about that.
Oh, did you like my Memojis, by the way?
Oh, yeah. Your Memojis have got a lot of laughs at my house.
Oh, they're so funny. I'll send you another one later. They're really, really good. They're good fun. Jake, where can people find you online and what should people do for you this week?
You can go to jakeknapp.com to find me. You can find me on Twitter at J-A-K-E-K. That's Jake K, the way I pronounce it. Or if you want to help me, could buy my book, Make Time. Or if you already bought it, you could write a review on Amazon. That would be really great. Or Goodreads, if you're a Goodreads user. Reviews are so helpful. And telling your friends about it is so helpful. If you go to maketimebook.com, there's like a little bonus pack. If you have bought it, you can get some cool stuff there. Thank you. And Jonathan, where can people find you? And what can they do to sort of butter up your tray?
Oh, Jesus. That sounds dirty.
I just assumed you were making cookies.
Oh, yeah, sure. So you can find me at JIceCream on Instagram. You can also find me at the same thing on Twitter, but I don't really use Twitter. If you want to butter up my tray, I don't know. Actually, you know, what would be cool, one of two things. Get me on a really popular podcast so I can tell them more about this podcast. That would be really, really great.
Jonathan
so
and I have a bet about how many listeners we'll have at the end of the year. Jonathan thinks we're going to have 10,000 subscribers at the end of the year.
I think we're not that far away from
I don't
that,
think we're going to get there. I'm more pessimistic.
I think we're
going to
get there.
And we've bet $20. Was it euros or dollars?
I think $20 because it's less.
Okay, $20. Because you're not optimistic because we're not going to get there. So if you want to help me, actually, don't do a review and an iPod and don't tell anybody about it. If you want to help Jonathan, if you want Jonathan to win my money, then share it with your friends, write reviews, but actually don't. don't do it. I want to win, and I'm confident I'm going to win. We're not going
to
get there.
100%. So what I'd like you to do, if you'd like to help us out, if you'd like to help me out personally so I can get that $20 off Jake, message people on Twitter, producty or designy podcasts that are popular. Tell them, oh man, Jonathan Courtney, you should get him on your podcast. Like, you know, if you watch any really good YouTube shows, I'll give you an example. Chris Doe from the future, he's been on this podcast before, but I'd love for him to ask me to come onto his YouTube channel and do a little collaboration. I mean, I could definitely ask him, but it's better if loads of other people ask him. Ask Chris Doe on Twitter. It'd be like, yo, bro, but don't tell him you heard it here.
Yo, Doe.
All right? That would ruin it.
Yeah.
That would ruin it. That would definitely ruin it. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Have a lovely week, and we'll see you next week. Hey!
Product Breakfast Club. Toast with jam. Other stuff that you eat. More breakfast.
Eating snakes.